Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, from August 26, 2017. This is the first of a series of talks and Sangha discussion on karma and rebirth. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
What a wonderful way to start the day, isn't it? I mean, really, I consider myself very fortunate to have the Sangha to meditate with. So thank you all for just having that opportunity. It's an example of skillful karma. Mm-hmm. So today's going to be the first of a series of talks. I'm kind of thinking it'll probably be over three Saturdays on karma and rebirth. Karma is one of the most misunderstood pop terms, but also one of the most misunderstood teachings of the Buddha within modern Buddhism. Karma is often diminished in importance or dismissed outright by saying the Buddha only taught karma to relate to common teachings of his time, and that's entirely untrue. Karma and rebirth are essential understandings when seen properly in the context of the Buddha's teachings, and you'll hear the words of the Buddha on karma and how important it is to understand it clearly. But the Buddha used karma to refute a very common and strongly held belief of his time, giving it even more importance to understanding karma. And then the pop application of karma, that if you having a bad day or a difficult life, that you have bad karma. That's entirely untrue. It has really no bearing on karma, and it's actually a hurtful thing to say to people. You know, well, you got a difficult life because you got bad karma. And the opposite is true too. That something good happens, or you're having a wonderful life, well, you've developed good karma. Well, that's kind of equally hurtful, isn't it? Because it's implying that everybody else has bad karma, and it just doesn't add up. I mean, the idea that there's a one-to-one relationship between what you've done and what will occur in your life is just ridiculous. I mean, if it was true, every one of us would be feverishly engaged in good acts, so we would receive good things. There's a famous sutta on, I can't think of the name of it, but the character, the main character besides the Buddha, is this gentleman named Angulimala, who was a bloodthirsty killer. So bloodthirsty that he would cut the fingers off of his victims, and he made a necklace out of it. Some of you have heard this. It's a rather unpleasant picture, but that's what he did. And Angulimala had 99 of these bloody fingers hanging around. And he's walking down the road one day, and he spots the Buddha, and he says, "That's my next victim. That's going to be number 100. And there's a long backstory to it. But eventually he encounters the Buddha. The Buddha's not afraid, for one thing, and he's mindfully present with Angulimala, and he understands the incredibly disturbed mind of this murderer that's standing in front of him. And he teaches him the Dhamma in brief. Angulimala understands. For one thing, he didn't hurt the Buddha, but he never harmed another soul. And when he died, it was acknowledged that he had become awakened. Now, the interesting thing in relation to karma is Angulimala killed nearly 100 people. He didn't have to suffer 100, he didn't have to be murdered 100 times in order to balance this silly karmic scale. All that he needed to do to let go of the ongoing results of his past behavior, including most importantly that agitated mind, was to take to the Dhamma and awaken. That's karma. So let me read a little bit from the article. Karma is continuity of dukkha within impermanence. So continuity often obscures impermanence. In fact, it does obscure impermanence. We think that we're stuck, especially if we don't have the proper framework for viewing our lives correctly, meaning the Eightfold Path. We think that we're stuck in the type of life that we're having because a series of events seems to keep occurring. But what we miss is that it's our reaction that's the same, because our action is rooted in ignorance. Is that clear? So it seems like the same thing keeps happening, that kind of Groundhog Day effect. But it's really our reaction to what's happening. The common occurrences of the world are common, but our reaction or skillful response is what can change. And that develops within karma. So karma can either be a continuation of a life rooted in ignorance, or it can be a mindful response to developing the Eightfold Path. Karma applies to both of those things. Okay. Karma is the present unfolding of past intentional acts moderated by present mindfulness. That's basically what I just said. Whatever the present level of our mindfulness is, it doesn't matter what's occurring or what's unfolding in our life. If our mindfulness is well concentrated and well framed by the Eightfold Path, our karma will be to continue towards awakening. If we continue to ignore the Eightfold Path, continue to ignore Four Noble Truths, we'll continue to develop karma that will only continue to develop a life more rooted in ignorance, continually rooted in ignorance. Is that clear? And that's really the choice of each moment. That's the potential of each moment has. Karma is the personal experience of the three marks of existence. So everything occurs within those three marks of existence, of impermanence, the not-self characteristic, and the resulting dukkha or suffering from not understanding the interaction of those two. So you could also say that that karma is a problem of lack of understanding, a lack of wisdom. Karma is ignorance. Karma is dukkha. Karma is suffering. But there's nothing arbitrary or predetermined about karma. That's probably the most important thing. The Buddha's words of karma: I am the owner of my actions and the heir to my actions. I am born of my actions and related through my actions. My actions will determine the fortune or misfortune in my life, determined by the level of my understanding. That's why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path, so we can understand what's going on and understand our contributions to an ongoing unsatisfactory life. Karma and rebirth are closely linked concepts of the Buddha's teachings. Many modern schools claim the Buddha taught karma and rebirth only to relate to the prevalent beliefs of his time. They hope to show that karma and rebirth are not useful or relevant teachings. Understanding karma and rebirth is essential to becoming awakened, or becoming Buddha. The Buddha's teachings on karma and rebirth refuted many of the common beliefs of his time. Understanding karma and rebirth helps clarify the purpose and experience of awakening. Understanding karma and rebirth as they were originally presented and in the context of the Four Noble Truths brings insight and clarity to the Eightfold Path. Understanding karma and rebirth can help one recognize contradictory and confusing Buddhist teachings that are later developed adaptations and accommodations to the original teachings. And most of those teach karma as retribution for past actions. Or that we can develop favorable karma by, the word is often used, by gaining merit, doing certain things. Now, it's true that thoughts, words, and deeds that are rooted in the virtuous factors of the Eightfold Path will develop a more pleasant life, but that's because we're clearing our minds of agitated mind states. Not because there's some outside force saying, oh, you were kind to that woman, you held the door for her, so I'm going to give you a lollipop. I mean, it just doesn't work that way. And when you think about it, that is that whole idea of gaining merit from some outside entity or some kind of grand spiritual scheme contradicts everything the Buddha said. It contradicts the First Noble Truth, doesn't it? Karma and rebirth are conditions arising from ignorance. Karma means action. Karma is in no way punishment as a result of arbitrary judgments from a supreme being. Karma is not the consequence from a vague interdependent moral, ethical, spiritual system. Karma is not a condition imposed on you or anybody else. You alone are the cause of your karma, and you alone are the cause of rebirth. And I'll get into rebirth a little bit later on. But I'm not, just to kind of clarify the context, I'm not only talking about a future birth. In fact, a future physical birth is almost irrelevant, but not completely, but almost irrelevant to how karma and rebirth unfolds in our life and the importance of understanding that. Karma should not be viewed simply as what is unfolding in our lives. Karma is the present unfolding of past intentional actions moderated by your present state of understanding and the quality of mindfulness. That's the second time I've said that, but that's the important definition to understand of karma. Whatever we hold in mind in the present moment will determine the unfolding of our karma. To say something for the second time again, each moment holds the potential to incline our minds towards a life further rooted in ignorance or inclined towards awakening. And that is how karma unfolds. If our mindfulness is rooted in concentration developed in meditation and well framed by the Eightfold Path, then our karma is actually a process of awakening. So no matter what we've done, no matter how confused, no matter what beliefs we've acquired, no matter what awful acts we may have done in the past, what is occurring right now is the most important thing. What's occurring in our minds and how we're viewing the world. If we're viewing the world from right view, we will continue to awaken. It does not mean that karma won't continue to unfold, which is the reason why many people feel like they're not getting there quick enough, because they've taken to the Dhamma, they're meditating a lot, they're reading the right things, but they're still having difficulty in their life. And they're reacting to that difficulty. When you react to the difficulty, when you want something to be different than it is, and it might mean that I want more of something that's given me pleasure, that's still a reaction based on lack, or reacting from aversion, you're simply continuing your karma because you're creating an agitated mind state. If what's occurring in your life, no matter what it is, good, bad, indifferent, if your mind is remaining at peace and seeing it clearly through the Eightfold Path, you will create no more additional karma in your life. And at that point, you can start untangling the conditioned thinking that you've developed.
Can you say that again?
I hope so.
I can listen to it later.
You might have
no
to.
No pressure.
I'm going to kind of rephrase it. What's occurring in this moment for each and every one of us is our lives unfolding in a dispassionate, impersonal way when we react to it, whatever it is, or respond skillfully by maintaining a peaceful and calm mind, will create what our next moment will be. So, if we are clinging to the events of the world, clinging to wanting to get more of what's giving me pleasure, or living with aversion and anxiety to what's occurring, I don't want any more of this, in that moment, we're creating, I hope I'm saying this in the right context, in this moment, we're creating the experience of karma. It has nothing to do, really, with what's occurring. It has to do with how I'm reacting or responding skillfully to whatever's occurring in our life.
Can I add something to that?
Yes, well, I just want to, Mary, did that cover?
Well, you said something about, and I missed the little lead up to it, but you said something about at some point, it almost sounded like you don't experience karma and you begin untangling
yes.
all the conditioned thinking.
Yes, yes. Yeah. You're right. I didn't yes. address that. Another way of looking at our conditioned thinking is thinking that is entangled with all the things that have occurred in the world and to us. And it's very difficult to unravel it. That's part of the of Dhamma practice, meditation, is looking at these attachments that we've made. Another word for the entanglement, clinging to views and events that should be different than they are. In the present moment, if we're maintaining the refined mindfulness rooted in concentration, we're able to see those things and start untangling or letting go of our clinging to those things. And then the Nagara Sutta, I realize I got to teach this again pretty soon because I keep referring to it. The Buddha describes that process of recognizing these entangled views with the world and letting them go. It's another way of saying we start untangling our karma in this present moment, whatever is occurring. If we find our minds, remember that we've been talking a lot about restraint this summer, beginning with those three, I think it was three talks on a series of on restraint. At the moment, if we can maintain mindfulness and practice restraint rather than react, it's another way of saying we're untangling those entanglements, we're unbinding the clinging, we're untangling our karma. And we're able to gain control then of our lives. Now, for most of us, as we develop the Dhamma, the conditioned thinking, the karma of past events is still going to come up in our minds, and there's going to be reaction. It's at that point of recognizing the reaction that we practice restraint. It's not enough to just get these concepts and our conditioned thinking just ceases for most of us. Kundana was one that awakened immediately. But in the moment, as we start developing restraint, developing a more calm and well-concentrated mind, we're able to have an effect on our past conditioned thinking, our past karma. So again, just to make that point, karma unfolding, again, is not some psycho-spiritual system that's imposed on us each moment. It's the result of our conditioned thinking. So again, we are the result of our conditioned thinking, our karma is. But the most important thing and the great power is recognizing that I am in control in this moment of how I respond or react to what's occurring in my life. And I can react or respond. I can react from a conditioned point of view, which means that I'll create further agitation in my life in some way. Or I can respond skillfully by understanding the impermanence and the not-self in everything that unfolds. Is that clear? Anthony, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, it's okay. I was just... When you were saying that when you want something to be different, that you're suffering, and that's a perpetuation of karma, I was also going to add that when you actually get what you want, you're not going to be happy with it for very long.
Absolutely. I just read a remarkable story, and it's not... We've heard it many, many times. There was a gentleman... I think it was in Kentucky, and he won $21 million. He went through it all in 6 years, and his life didn't end pleasantly. And you think of most of us, when you first think of, wow, what the greatest thing in $21 million, everything in my life is solved. Mm-hmm. Of course, most of us would realize that won't solve everything. But it's really that, isn't that, you would all believe you, and I wouldn't, somebody who said, here's $21 million, I'm not going to say no. But I hope I would respond skillfully and realize that $21 million or $1 million or $21 doesn't define me. Because if we attach ourselves to that type of thing, to anything like that. I used to notice years ago, and I'm getting a little bit off it. This is going back quite a few years, but I always felt better about myself the more money I had in my wallet. Have you experienced that? I just did. Life seemed better, and I seemed, if I had a nice fat wallet. It took me a while to realize what an identity I had to having a couple hundred bucks on me. And that my happiness was tied to being a little bit off kilter and sitting down. But we all do that. We identify ourselves with external things, whether it's money or power or friends or clothes or anything else, my nice Hawaiian shirt. We're setting ourselves up for painful karma to unfold by clinging to those things. So thank you for bringing it up. Jen, you had your hand up? Did I talk right through it?
Concentration. allows you to see. Well, I guess if we develop concentration, then we begin to recognize our reactions to
yes.
people and events of the world. And then perhaps we recognize that our reaction is often the same. And then that kind of points towards conditioning.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. The purpose of meditation is to develop that type of concentration that supports the refined mindfulness that we can see what's unfolding through right view in the rest of the Eightfold Path. And at that point of recognition, we can see the continuation of ignorance, or we can incline our minds towards awakening. And it's at that point that we practice, hopefully, restraint. And the next thing from restraint is renunciation. There's not a long process of, wow, I recognize that this is an unskillful response, and where did it come from? Why do I do it? But then you're lost. Then you're lost in the distraction of analysis. simply recognize it. And this is where the four foundations of mindfulness, remember the series we just went through, come into play, recognizing that this, I have a feeling that is less than peaceful. Notice it. Notice it and let it go. The Buddha would often use the word abandon, and I recognize this in myself. And he would say, and I simply, I think it's going to be Tuesday's talk, will be on a sutta where he references this again, and I simply abandoned it. So when we find ourselves agitated, rather than get into the process of the agitation, and that agitation could be, could feel like bliss or happiness by having won $21 million. Once we notice that at that point of agitation, that my mind is agitated, simply abandon the feeling or the thought and come back to the present moment. That's a well-concentrated mind. But it obviously it takes concentration to be able to do that, doesn't it?
Or you can choose, you can see the reaction and you can choose restraint.
Yes.
From kind of doing what the reaction is calling you to do.
Yes, and that's really what Mary was asking me to clarify.
Right.
That,
yeah.
You said it much more clearly than I did. It's at that point. We recognize we're caught up in it. We practice renunciation, meaning we abandon it, and we maintain. So even if, again, as we begin our Dhamma practice, we're still likely going to have some agitated mind states. The reason why we have developed concentration is to recognize that mind state and not let it get any further, not let it continue our karma in a negative way. Negative is not really the right way to say that, but in a skillful way, we can continue developing awakening.
But and then you can have karma. So then if you have that moment of recognition, and then you have the choice to restrain and not react to, or not do what the reactions are calling you to do, that part, that's the difficult part.
Yes.
I think over time, though, as you see that that reaction is the same all the time, or similar.
Oh, yeah.
It becomes easier to not lose concentration. But that's still karma. You're still choosing, or becoming.
Yes.
Awakened or not awakened. And that's kind of where the karma, that's where karma is.
Yep. So it's until awakening, yes, it is good. Until awakening, we're still experiencing aspects of life as dukkha, as unsatisfactory. That's another word for rooted in conditioned thinking. It's simply another word for karma. If you want to know what your karma is, take a look in the mirror. Because then you should look at karma as completely impersonal. It's not good or bad. It's not even skillful or unskillful, except what we do with it. Karma simply is what's occurring in our life. We all got it until that point of awakening. And the reason why I say that is at that point, which could happen for any one of us today, it doesn't take lifetimes, the reason why I'm saying that. At that point, we simply stop creating the conditions for our own disappointment in life. Life still occurs, but we no longer react to it because we understand. The Buddha described awakening as understanding suffering, but understanding it on such a profound level that we stop reacting to it. If we don't take anything personal, no matter what occurs, because we know there's nothing personal about anything. Except, it could truly be said, the only thing we should take personal is, the sutta on the second arrow, is when we stick the second arrow, when we react, that's what we should take personally. But not in a way to blame ourselves or beat ourselves up, just because that's what we're in control of. That's really the only thing that is personal in life. I interrupted you again, Jen. I'm sorry.
No, you didn't. I feel like I'm maybe over trying to understand, but like the Buddha still had. Did he have karma? His karma was just happening. It's just what's happening.
It's a great question,
it's also
and
how you're reacting to what's happening.
Yes. So you. The Buddha didn't. Really the only reasonable way to answer the question is, upon the Buddha's awakening, like any other arahant, he ceased creating additional karma in his life.
Yeah, that's tough.
Yeah.
I'm gonna need some time with that
one. Well, what it means is he stopped creating the conditions in his own mind for agitation.
Yeah, but that's not completely true, because you've read some suttas where he calls people fools. There's a little bit of emotion in that.
No, well, you're seeing that from your point of view. He was referring to a person being foolish in the most compassionate terms, to make a strong point. It was always when someone was taking license with the Dhamma and also teaching it. And that's the most foolish thing anybody can do. And to hit somebody right between the eyes with it, I think is the essence of compassion. You know, and so he wasn't creating any more karma. He did that very skillfully. He didn't do it arbitrarily. There's a few suttas in where the Buddha actually gets physically ill. One is the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the sutta of the last 3 years, 3 months of his life, where he was given some rancid pork. And the description of his physical suffering is like you can imagine, someone who had severe food poisoning. But it also points out how he didn't create any additional karma by accepting it as what's occurring and his interaction with Ananda, who was mostly with him through that. But also, the person that gave him the bad pork was this guy named Kunda. There's a few characters named Kunda in the suttas. And nowhere does he say, what a SOB, how could he, what a fool, what, you know, he should rot in hell or any other foolish thing. What he did say was he told Ananda, don't let Kunda know because it'll destroy him. Even in his own suffering, he practiced great compassion because he knew there's no good that would come from that. Okay, this may be a 4 or 5-parter. But that's okay. I think I said 4 at the 4 Foundations of Mindfulness, and that was 7. So we'll see.
Yeah.
But this is such an important topic, isn't it? You know, it's not something we should just.
The birth part yet?
Yeah, I haven't given birth to that yet. So let me find out where I was. I'll go back one paragraph. Karma should not be viewed simply as what is unfolding in your life. Karma is the present unfolding of past intentional actions, moderated by your present state of understanding and quality of mindfulness. And just a quick point of clarification there, then I'll move on. The reason why I say intentional actions is there's such a thing as worldly causes and conditions. We are not responsible for everything that happens to us or in the world, although some people will take it on. A great disaster like what's occurring in Texas to those poor people is an example of that. The people that are getting whacked by Hurricane Harvey aren't responsible for it. They just happen to be living in that part of the world when it's occurring. Now, you could say their reactions to what's occurring would further their karma, but that's kind of besides the point. Things happen as a consequence of having a human life. The Buddha describes suffering as birth is suffering. Slow down a little bit. Sickness is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering, not getting what you want, getting what you don't want, in short, the 5 clinging aggregates of suffering. He's describing a human life. Those things we have absolutely no control over, but it is our reaction or clinging that those things be different that creates karma. And so it's intentional actions that lead towards furthering karma. Is that clear? And again, if that wasn't the truth, we really would be living uncontrolled lives. We'd have no control over what's occurring. As your present state of mindfulness and understanding animate your current thoughts, words, and deeds, your current actions are moderating the effects of past thoughts, words, and deeds. That's clear? However I'm reacting or responding to what's occurring now is going to determine what happens in the next moment. Really, what it determines the quality of my mind in the next moment. What this means is a key to developing the Dhamma. Through mindfulness informed by wisdom and motivated by right intention, the unfolding of karma can be inclined towards release and awakening. Developing understanding of the process originating in ignorance, resulting in confusion and suffering, brings the ability to end ignorance through developing wisdom. That's the whole point of the Dhamma. From ignorance, suffering arises. From wisdom, awakening arises. where was I? By understanding the causes and conditions of suffering, we can reverse the process. Again, that's the whole point of the Eightfold Path. Karma does not predetermine life. Mindful and well-concentrated intention within the framework of the Eightfold Path develops release from craving and clinging and the cessation of suffering. I think I'll just read this one more quote and we'll call it today. The Buddha's words. Whatever one continues to pursue with their thinking becomes the inclination of their awareness. Whatever we pursue with our thinking. Being mindful of right intention and abandoning thinking imbued with craving. Notice those words again. Abandoning thinking. Not figuring it out. Not analyzing it. Abandoning thinking imbued with craving. Imbued with craving, clinging, and sensuality inclines the mind towards release. I think that's a good place to stop today. Thank you. Any questions directly on what we talked about today, and then we'll go around the room. Okay. Tommy, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Well, thank you. Yeah, it just seems, we've had talks in the past, it just seems that a process towards this peace is the alleviation of everything. You know, everything that we're sold, everything that, you know, the world that we're in now, it's a real struggle and a real battle to try to find, that kind of consistent peace.
Yes.
Certainly for me, you know, speaking for me, my foundation works in the inner city, and I deal with children and families in very unfortunate circumstances who seem to have had even more of the selling heaped upon them,
yeah.
Whatever that is, product, anything. But there's, for instance, they've never heard a note of classical music. I sell hip-hop to them just because it gets them moving. It's
yeah.
The first step in a longer path. But even that is selling what is the culture. And so I just see so much, and I deal with so much conflict, in that process that, I found myself the other day with my head in my hands at my computer, just having to try to, it was dramatic, and I thought, well, I really have progressed. I have made some progress, I know that, but whew, some days, man, just get the guy with the baseball bat away from me, it's daunting, and it's dreadful. Those things play out. They balance out good days, bad days. But it's always a pleasure to come here to try to release some of that and set a different mind path, which in itself is very helpful. So thank you very much.
Thank you for talking about that, Tommy. When the Buddha described his awakening and how he now was looking out on the world, his thoughts to himself, and I'll teach the Nagara Sutra maybe right after we're done with this here because I keep referring to it. He looked out in the world and he said, "The world is a flame, and it's just as a flame today as it was back then. There's still there's whole classes of people, whole groups of people that seem to suffer much more than other classes, and that's just." That's all part of, that's described as dukkha. That's what I refer to as worldly causes and conditions. They're no longer responsible for their situation than we are for having a pleasant life out here in Frenchtown. It's part of worldly causes and conditions. But what do we do with that? How do we respond and reconcile that? Some of us will feel very torn by it and even feel like, well, I don't deserve to have the life that I'm living because other people are suffering. That's not based in reality. What I would ask you to do, because of what you just said, and maybe we should all look at, is read the Ratana Sutta again. It's on the website. It's also in a new book. The Ratana Sutta is a sutta of, it shows the Buddha's response to a town that was devastated by environmental floods, etc., and also disease and famine. And what he did, and the first thing he did was he addressed the needs, the physical needs of the people in the town. He didn't just go in there and say, ah, you guys, you know, you don't have to worry about any of this. Just meditate and take to the Dhamma, because that would be foolish. He addressed their physical needs first to each and every one of the people in that town. There were 500 monks and nuns with him. And then, after their physical needs were met, he gave them a teaching on the Dhamma. And that's where the triple refuge came by, because in that sutta, he tells the folks, you know, do what you need to do to take care of yourselves physically, and then take refuge in the Buddha, that an awakened human being has developed a way to live in the world no matter what occurs and maintain a peaceful and calm mind. And take refuge in the Dhamma. Here's my teaching, which you gave right there. And then take refuge in each other and develop a sangha around these teachings. It's the most important thing you can do. And the expedient means is so important too, to use hip-hop. You know, I wouldn't say that you're just selling them something. That's a way to reach them. It's very skillful.
Come visit. You'll see.
Maybe I will. I'd love to. Thank you. Becky, good to see you this morning.
Thank you. Good to be here. Who was 47 years old, died of a ruptured brain aneurysm 3 weeks ago, just before we were all set to go on a 2-week trip together to the beach. So I've just been sad. We went to the beach anyway, and we had a very therapeutic few days together, all of us. And when I think back on that, I don't know how much of the practice or of what I've been learning here I was able to use in that situation. And I don't really remember realizing, I mean, I don't really remember stopping to respond rather than react. But at the time it was happening, because I really felt like I was just sort of in a fog, and I feel like all of us were just trying to distract each other in kind ways and, you know, trying to laugh together when we could, cry together when we needed to, and give each other as much space as we could, because of course his sister was with us and his fiance was with us, so it was much more difficult. It was a much more difficult death for them than it was for us. Mm-hmm. But in looking back on what that was like, I do, only in retrospect, but not at the moment, you're talking about karma, is making the decision and being aware of the decision at the moment. I'm still not there yet, but in looking back, I realized there were the times when I reacted. And there were times when I responded, but the reaction was, you know, mainly at the, like, yelling at the doctors, not really yelling, but getting really upset in the hospital room at some point when I just thought the doctors were not just not relating to us the way they should have been relating to us for what we were going through. But that was really wrong speech, wrong reaction, or a reaction that wasn't, that was a reaction rather than a response, ill-considered. But for the most part, I do think that this practice did help in some ways that I'm really not even aware of, maybe. But so we're still sad.
Yeah.
And that's mainly the biggest, that's the emotion that's happening right now. And I'm just not upset about it. I'm just being sad because it's sad.
Yeah, it is. Thank you, Becky. That's the appropriate feeling. Rather than thinking, oh, I shouldn't be sad, or I should be, or whatever else you might put
it's
on that.
It's not fun to be sad. I don't want to be sad, but, you know, it's
but,
sad.
Yeah. And, you know, it sounds silly. Now's the time for you to be sad.
Right.
You know? It really would be almost psychopathic if you weren't now, you know. It's one of the great misunderstandings that if you develop this, the Dhamma, you cease feeling and you cease thinking. And it's really just the opposite. You're able to be fully present with life as life occurs in the most appropriate way. And it's entirely appropriate for you to be sad. And even in those stressful situations, it's not the highest goal to, I'm talking about when you're talking to the doctor. But you recognize that. You're not trying to justify it.
Well, mostly because Jen pointed it out.
But that's how the Dhamma works too. So we learn to be as mindfully present as we can until we get to the point where we are simply mindfully present with a well frame, and that you recognize it is really the most important thing. And I'm not saying that in a general way or to make you feel good. Recognition is the most important point of the whole Dhamma. Know what's going on right now. Know that I'm reacting in a less than skillful way. But also recognize the times when it helped you. It was a practical benefit. So thank you for bringing it up. It helped everyone this morning.
Thank you.
And we're sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
Anthony, good to see you.
Good to see everyone. Sorry for the loss of your nephew.
Thank you.
There's just times, I think, where, you know, you can apply the practice and karma, and times where it's just too challenging.
Because
I remember when my dad was dying, he had an aneurysm too. And I remember being angry at my stepmother for ceasing the life support and wanting to put him in hospice, because I couldn't accept it.
Yeah.
You know? So, I mean, we all have that, and it's just natural. I think with, you know, understanding impermanence and you can handle the little things easier, but the big things like that are just really hard.
Yeah.
And you know, just have to accept how you feel, because it does go away, it gets better. But you know, I just be thankful for the little things, like, you know, like I can. I had somebody yesterday, because I couldn't make a reunion of my friends in Queens 3 years in a row, but I had legitimate reasons, and then he put this on Facebook. Well, if you miss one more year, you're not invited anymore. And I was like looking at that, like, how do I respond to that? And then I just said, I don't respond to it, and I liked it. And I felt good about that. You know, or going back and forth with a friend for 7 months now, every time we plan a dinner, she and her boyfriend cancel. And I would have been really mad about that, but now I'm like, okay, that's what it is, you know. So, I mean, the little things we can handle, it's the big things like that. They test our karma.
Yeah. And all we can do is the best we can do. That. And feel fortunate that we have a framework for seeing these things clearly.
Right. That's what helped.
Yeah. Thank you, Anthony. Jen, good to see you this morning.
Thank you, John. Oh, thank you. I feel like I've shared enough today, but I just want to say thank you so much for teaching and just your presence and your authenticity and your mindfulness, because it's really changed my life. So I thank you for that.
Thank you for saying that. Glad you're here this morning. Eva, good morning. How are you?
Thank you, John, and thank you, everyone, because every time there's just so much to learn from one another, and I'm grateful for that. Thank you.
Glad you're here. Mary, good to see you this morning.
Good to see you. And since Isabel isn't here, how are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Good. That's wonderful. And this is really good. I feel like I know what it's like to have approached, before I was learning this, and maybe I was listening to something else, to approach life by thinking that if you do good and put goodness out into the world, you know, it'll return back to you.
Mm-hmm.
But in hindsight, that was a distraction to the aversion I was experiencing. You know, in my life, I would handle that same situation quite differently and more skillfully today. And I'm happy about that. I like what you said about the untangling piece. I just think that's a perfect metaphor for the conditioned thinking that, and kind of the analogy I use to understand karma is like, you know, those old-fashioned glasses, or even when you go to get your eyes checked and they try different lenses out, you know, and you're looking at, and your lenses are just really muddy and you don't know it. You know, and then also you're like, you know, and then you have right view of a situation. And I often tell, I have a lot of people that I oversee, and I'll tell them that. I say, it's just that your lenses are muddy, you're not seeing the situation clearly right now. When they think they're justified and right by their reaction to something in the workplace. But this is really good, the untangling of conditioned thinking. It helps to create that right view, that clears my muddy lenses.
Yeah, thank you. And you have to be, as part of right effort, you have to be willing to do it. Most people don't. You know,
right.
They come up, I'm not letting go of anything.
Well, you know what's interesting is to help people, at least in my work, to help people, like, feel that just, like, stop them in their tracks and say, you do know you have another choice in how to respond to this situation. And because I think that's called me in my face.
Yeah.
I have another way to look at this. Are you kidding me? I'm going to look at this. What if he's not here? How am I going to look at it differently? Right? And it calls you straight up to say, oh, my God.
Yeah.
I am holding on to that thing. I also had a really auspicious day yesterday. I was, I love that suit.
The Banakarana Sutta.
And I was really at peace. My concentration is very good. I almost rarely have to write things down now. And I have a really, you know, like anybody else, I have a really, really busy job, multiple clients, multiple projects going on. And I just did some really good work yesterday where I was so pleasant and pleased, and I recognized it, you know, just in a very dispassionate way, that this is, you know, like, wow, if this was what normal means, this would be very nice, you know? Yeah, it was a really great day, and I really thank the practice for that, so I thank you as well.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thank you for sharing that. That is an auspicious day.
It was.
And to be mindful of it is the essence of an auspicious day.
Yes.
To know where it comes from. Thank you. Mary, good morning. Good to see you.
Good to be here. I'm in a state of agitation over something ridiculous. At least in the car, you think that would not cause agitation.
Mm-hmm.
But just it's just another change, and it's just a change that I'm going through alone. And I've never done that.
Yeah.
And I keep telling myself, and I do get beyond it, but it's just, you know, I say, this is silly. This is... First of all, your feelings will change. The agitation will go away. And this is, life is stressful. There is stress. And you need to just don't react to the agitation. Recognize that it's there. Take a deep breath and walk forward. And, I mean, the whole practice, I mean, helps me immensely, because I mean, I could spiral into a real tizzy over something as ridiculous as this, just because it's a new step.
Yeah, it's unfamiliar.
It's a great help.
Thank you for sharing that with the group. It's a common occurrence. It's framed by dukkha.
Yeah.
You know, and to be able to bring the Dhamma into it and see it in that clearly as it is really, again, it's the essence of what we're doing. So thank you. Glad you're here this morning. Debbie, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Good to see you. I'm good. I missed coming last week. I was away, and I feel that absence so much, you know, when I don't get here once a week. So this was a little bit difficult for me to understand, and I felt like it was so helpful when people were asking their questions and trying to make sense of it, like Jan and Mary and stuff like that was really helpful, because it's like kind of that repetitive, different way of understanding or bringing in the information, so it helped a lot. Being here and the energy, feeling the positive energy in my meditation and being with the Sangha. And I also just want to say to Jen and Becky, I'm really sorry for your loss.
Mm-hmm.
And also to you, Mary, because I think going through something long for some time is bringing up the loss.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Just be gentle.
Yeah, always. Thank you, Debbie. I mean, this, what you just said, and really every class, is it shows how important the Sangha is. You know, and it really is, it's remarkable what has developed here in Frenchtown. Well, it's interesting how the Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday are, there's some interlap, I guess is the right word. But almost three separate sanghas, but we're all so supportive of each other, and we're able to be so supportive is because we're actually developing the Dhamma. I mean, that's why it works. That's why it's somewhat unique. So, again, thank you all for that. Lorna, good to see you this morning.
Very good class. Thank you very much. Very concentrated. And sound like it on record play, but I need to go home and listen to the play and hear it all again. And I've said that every time, but it's true. I you know, when I go home and settle down, I can hear it a bit more than being here. But getting back to karma, is it right that I've mentioned in my meditation? You can get to the place where you're really just softly thinking about your breath and there's no thought. I mean, is that a karmic less moment? You know, is that a moment without karma? Because there's no resistance to the next. There's no resistance to the next moment. There's just nothing.
It's a moment where you're not contributing in any type of unskillful way to your karma unfolding.
Yeah.
You know, because there's no reaction in your mind.
Yeah.
And meditation can be like that. It's not a goal to try to find a place where it seems like there's no thought, there's only your breath. But it often occurs as our concentration deepens. And it also refers to that word that a lot of people apply to meditation practice as it's developed, meaning spaciousness. Because there actually is, we're not clinging one thought to the next so immediately. And there actually is space between our thoughts. So yeah, it we're not, and in that moment, we're not contributing any unskillful karma.
Right.
And it's also important to recognize it, because that's a deep level of meditative absorption. It's the fourth jhana.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. Sure.
Well, this is just am I right in thinking this, just put it that way, that when we have a moment that we feel unsure, we're going to a new place, we're going to meet new people, we're going to have that, and we have that unsure feeling, is that because our anatta is not established in the new moment? Is that what we're feeling? by my fear of resistance to, or nervousness to a new surrounding or new confrontation in life. Not by life, new something in life. Is that because anatta has to, when anatta gets established in that new situation, then we. Is that what that is?
Interesting.
Yes. It is, because of the underlying understanding that underlies the question. You have to have a pretty profound understanding of the Dhamma to even pose the question. Mm-hmm. So, uncertainty is an aspect of impermanence. Right? We never know what the next moment is going to bring. But when we've created something in our minds of an upcoming event and we're uncertain of it, it's because we're caught in that feedback loop of impermanence, the not self-characteristic, and the resulting dukkha. In this case, it's anxiety. An unfamiliar situation is something that a self-referential ego personality creates anxiety over it because it has no control over it. It doesn't know, there's no conditioned response yet except anxiety, which is really that underlying fear or worry, anxiety, is really the constant tension of ongoing dukkha or ongoing stress that results from ignorance. And think about what ignorance means. When anxiety arises because of this future scenario, it's because we don't know how it's going to be for me, rather than understand, well, my life's unfolded as it's unfolded without me putting any control over it at all. Mm-hmm. So, am I answering your question?
I know, but isn't that me, karma?
Isn't that what?
When you referred to me, isn't that karma?
Mm-hmm.
Not me, not.
I mean, the concern about me in the future.
No. Me needing to establish me.
Oh yeah, that's an aspect of karma. The whole confused conditioned cycle is karma unplaying. Playing out in your life. So you're creating in that somewhat confusing scenario, meaning not the way you explained it, confused in your own mind about what's going to occur, is an aspect of karma unfolding. It's also an aspect of dukkha. It's also an aspect of anatta, not understanding who you are. Views rooted in the wrong view of self. It will only lead to anxiety in those situations. So,
in that definition of karma, I haven't memorized it, but the past, whatever, unfolding here, mirrored by how you see, you know, how muddy your glasses are, however you say it. I think there's some of that in there that explains the uncertainty, right? It's the past.
Yes.
The
definition of, the best definition that I can come up with, karma is the present moment unfolding of past intentional actions.
Yes.
Moderated by the present level of mindfulness, meaning however our mindfulness is framed. If we're holding in mind the framework of the Eightfold Path and seeing things somewhat clearly at least, then the moment won't lead to a further agitated moment or further karma. But in the scenario that Lauren is describing, it's lacking that framework of the Eightfold Path because there's anxiety about whatever may occur.
And that's
the conditioned response.
And that's what you're feeling. So you have to see that anxiety is what you have to abandon.
Yes.
And
again,
just go into the moment. This is brand new.
Yeah, uncertainty is an aspect. uncertainty is an aspect of impermanence. I mean, it's obvious that it is, but we don't want anything to be uncertain. We want a self-referential ego self wants to have complete control over everything that occurs. But even on a more subtle level, a self-referential ego self insists on having control over every thought that occurs, and that creates that underlying the first noble truth. Dukkha occurs moment by moment as karma unfolds, unless our minds are well concentrated and well framed by the Eightfold Path. So, I mean, it's really remarkable the level of understanding in the room, mm-hmm. Because of the questions of karma, because that's what it is. Mm-hmm. Thank you. And I'll have to talk up within a couple hours. Listen to it again.
You did last
week. I did. I don't have much. I got a little bit. I'll get it up as soon as I can, but it'll probably be up by the middle of the afternoon. Liz, good to see you.
Good to see you.
Welcome back.
Thank you. I had so many different thoughts as everyone was talking about where I sit with karma, and some of them were sort of, not real pleasant thoughts, and like Anthony was talking about someone who keeps changing, a scheduled time that you're supposed to get. I experienced that yesterday. Mm. And I kept saying to my husband, I'm almost through this. And I'd say one more thing about how frustrated I was. And then I'd say, I thought you said you were... I said, no, I said, I'm almost through this. I said, give me another 20 minutes and I'll be through this. But I was, as everyone's talking, I was thinking about this sort of, this metaphorical thing that I went through. My husband and I just traveled 2,200 miles through Canada and Nova Scotia and Cape Breton, and on our day off, we'd go for a ride. So it was, it was a lot of seeing a lot of beauty. One of the things we did was we went kayaking in the Bay of Fundy. Nice. And if you know the Bay of Fundy, the tidal bore creates a reverse. The river runs the opposite way because it's a 40-foot tide. So when the tide is out, the side of the banks are this clay, mud, brown shale, and then you see it full, and it's like, oh, you see it full. And then you see it empty, and you're like, it's just this mud. So I was having anxiety about this kayaking experience because I am a fair-weather kayaker. That's how I see myself. So we're approaching the river, and I'm having my normal anxiety about new experiences and being in the water and the whole thing. And I'm thinking to myself, can I do this? Almost to the point of breathing heavy and all of that. And as we come down the hill to see the Bay of Fundy, it's chocolate milk. It's and my husband starts saying, chocolate milk? He goes, I'm not kayaking in this mud and muck. And what are we going to see? And what are we going to do? And I'm thinking to myself, oh, good, I can get out of this. And I said, and so we I tried not to say too much and just kind of was managing my own anxiety. And we get down to the water and everything. And my husband can't believe that we're actually going to go kayaking in this muck. Because you literally can't see in the water, and there's no actual photosynthesis in the water. There's one type of seaweed that grows. It's salt water. So we get down there, we get in our kayaks, and they're saying, okay, well, today the waves are only 2 feet. So I'm thinking, 2 feet? Oh, okay, all right, well, now we're this far. We've got our jackets on, we're in the kayaks, we've got to go. So we start... we start going out, and when you're sideways, as the waves are coming in, the boat is rocking, And I'm just, trusting the strength of my husband to plow us through and get us through this. And they had us stopping at each bay, and stopping is hard because you're banging into kayaks and stuff. But about halfway through, I get a little more relaxed and comfortable with our rhythm with rowing and all of that. And the muddy water's not so bad because you're in a phenomenal situation. What are the chances of doing this twice, right? because I don't know if I would do it again. You get halfway out there, you know, and we're rowing, and I get out there, and there is an acre of foam on the water. And I get out there, and I go, it's just foam on the water. And the foam was this thick.
And then she took a picture and sent it to Helen and I.
It was like cappuccino. So by the time I got back to shore and we're ready to get out of the kayaks, I'm like, as we're rowing back, he says, now the waves are going to increase to about 3 feet. I'm like, 3 feet. I'm rowing back and I'm fine. And now the water has risen and we're going through sort of like open archways of stone, and we're like managing through. And so, and I know this about myself, that once I get into a situation, it's going to have some anchor of familiarity to it. There are certain things I can rely on. And I was so glad I did it. And in fact, by the time we got back, the water had come up far enough on the shoreline that we didn't even have to haul the boats far, and you know, it just, so you know, I have to remember that rather than, you know, it's, I used to scuba dive too, and there was so much anxiety with that, but I just have to remember that, you know, it's foam on the water, it's gonna be okay. I had a life jacket on. I, you know, it was, the water wasn't even that deep, you know? And so, you know, it's just, metaphorically, there's a lot of stuff going on there, and it probably has nothing to do with karma, but I just felt like it was like all these things were coming together. Anyway, I did it. So,
good for you.
I found strength in what I've learned here, you know?
Well, all things are impermanent.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Anyway.
Glad you're back. Any other lingering questions or comments? We'll continue Karma and Rebirth next week and probably for the next 10 or 15 weeks.
John, I just wanted to share, I like the series idea.
Yeah.
You know, doing something and your flexibility to do it for as long as it takes. Or, I really look forward to that. I think also from a business perspective, it gives people another reason to come another day.
That's the only reason I do it. Keep it coming.
But I mean, that's somebody has to be looking out for you, John.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
But, you know, it does. And if I could come every Tuesday and every Saturday, I really would. It just gives another reason for coming, and it creates a sense of organization.
Yeah.
Now, having done this for a little bit of time, understanding how the sutras are grouped and all of that is like fascinating and
I think so.
Enriching and just rich, you know. Yeah. So if we do a series of a deeper concentration in a certain area, it's like a gift, you know, and I just think it's such a great idea, so thank you.
Thank you for saying that. Yeah, it really doesn't do the topic or the topics, you know, karma and rebirth. It doesn't give them their proper due to try and do it all at once. It really takes what it takes. And also because as a Sangha, we've developed enough to have insightful views and questions that the discussion and it was at least as important as the teaching itself, wasn't it? You know, and how long, you know, however long that takes is how long it takes. So if it is 15 more weeks, that's great. That's what it took, you know. And it's such an important, karma and rebirth are really, one of those essential aspects of the Dhamma. So you know, we get it. So thank you. Thank you all. We'll finish with the metta as we always do. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future, or that may have arisen from our talk today. And metta means goodwill and loving kindness, and it's both an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path and an ongoing expression of an awakened, fully mature human being. And these are the Buddha's words from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.